Yes, good afternoon. My name is Angela White Noreen, and I'm the moderator for today and the hostess, and along with my guest that we have on the line, Mr. Keith Plummer. He's a director, writer, cinematographer, and he has currently two films that are out. Keith and I attended high school together, Potomac High School, and I'm going to have him pretty much sort of introduce himself more in terms of who he is, what Plum Good Productions does, and give you a little bit of, you know, background where you can go about going to see these movies and films and how you can support Keith as well as myself in regards to the work that we're trying to do here. So, Keith, Mr. Plummer, if you like, you can – I'm going to call you Keith. If you is that what you prefer?
That's all I've ever heard you call me, so you know.
Okay. All right. Okay, great. All right, Keith. If you can go and just tell us who you are.
I'm Keith Plummer. I'm a director cinematographer from Plum Good Productions and Plum Good Cinema. I'm from the Washington D.C. area, the DMV, went to school. As Andy said, we went to high school together in, at Potomac and Ocean Hill. I went to college in, at Towson University. And then I started working in news broadcast as working in D.C., covering different administrations, starting with Reagan all the way up through halfway at Bush W. So I got to cover a lot of the major events that went on. So, Anne, what would you like to know?
Well, and Keith and his, honestly, he forgot to tell us that he majored in journalism. And I think the audience would like to know what brought you to this field in the first place, and how, you know, what's your formula for being so successful within only 9 years of being in the industry?
Well, I think it's one of those things where I'm an only child, and I kind of grew up with a camera in my hand, so it's a running joke in my family that I'm not in pictures as a kid, because I'm the one that's always taking the pictures. So it's very few shots of me. But I've always we traveled a lot as a kid, and fortunate my parents were able to take me around the world, and I took pictures in different places, and I was just the guy with the camera. And when I went to college, I wound up being a mass communications major and journalism concentration, and took pictures in the yearbook and for the communications paper, and that just worked on. I just kept doing that kind of thing, and when it was time to graduate, I tried to find out what could I do, and did an internship. Back then, there was a Baltimore had two newspapers. It was the News American and the Baltimore Sun, and I had an internship at the News American, and they were actually going under, and which left the Baltimore Sun as the only newspaper in Baltimore. So I wasn't going to get a job at the News American because it was no longer going to be there. Hunted around, and I found a job. They were looking for interns at the startup TV station in Baltimore, and it wound up that I called and said, I'm a graduate, but I'll be willing to intern. And they wound up giving me a job at working in the control room. And that was my first TV job. And I worked at that station for 3 years, learned how to shoot video because I had never shot video before, and learned how to edit, and I worked in the control room. It was a fun job because we used to run all the oldies, you know, Rawhide and Bob Newhart and Mary Tyler Moore and all the Waltons. We used to watch those old shows. Which
that
was
great.
I mean, it was an interesting thing. So, but after about 3 years, I was ready to move on, and I got a job working for D.C. Washington Bureau. It was called Sun World Satellite News, and covered stations in the Sun Belt. And that's how I started working on Capitol Hill. And then after a while there, I got a job working at Hearst, Washington, Hearst Washington Bureau, and Hearst had some stations around the country, and I worked there as one of the two videographers, and we did stories, national stories, every day. So whatever the big news every day was, those were the stories we did, and I stayed working at Hearst, and my whole news career, because I was able to go up through the ranks and eventually became chief photographer, and that was my beat. I got to see a lot of fun stuff, a lot of interesting stuff, a lot of stuff I can't tell anybody about. You know, it was I had clearances to places and meeting with dignitaries and all that kind of stuff. It was a real fun job. But one thing about doing news, because news is so structured, is that you're able to be creative, but you're not being able to be as creative as you really or as I wanted to be. I always felt that there was something more that I wanted to do, and while I was working there 1 year, I said I was going to do a short film, and by the end of the year, and it was December, and I hadn't done the short film. So I got a bunch of people together that were worked in the news business, and I shot that film. It was 10 minutes long. It's called The Truth. And I didn't think much about it, but as I entered in a couple of film festivals back then, you know, whatever. You know, I just did it, and I didn't think much about it. But a few months later, there was this cylinder in my mailbox, and I was like, what's this? And I opened it up, and it said that I was a finalist in the film festival. And I was like, what? But fortunately or unfortunately, that became the catalyst into what has got me on this road that I've been on for the last many, many years. It at that point, it just said, you know, I could make films, I can do commercials, I can direct, and that's what got me going, believe it or not. That one little cylinder in the mailbox certificate.
Right, right.
And you were a finalist in this film festival.
That was great. That was a blessing. Keith, if you had it all for the young people out there who want to get into this field, if you had it all over, if you had to do it all over again, you know, we could, you know, older people always want to make believe this, but given that we have young people who are listening and a lot of young people who are very interested in this career, what advice would you give to a young person? Some of your pitfalls, things that could make the leap into this career easier for them, or give them, you know, certain guidance. I remember myself meeting Ms. Poussant when I was at Upper Bound, the Upper Bound program at University of Maryland, and she was trying her best to get me into productive communications. It was funny, but after she told us her story about how she got her chance as an African-American woman, that's the only reason why she got that chance, because of the riots that was going on back then. But what advice would you give young people, Keith, in terms of how one can get into this film, what some of the pitfalls or bumps in the road that they can look and maneuver around probably, maybe? And two, what type of challenges would they be looking, you know, forward to in terms of getting in this career? Because I know this is a career that's very unique, and it's very you know, it's not open to a whole, it's not open up to a lot of people. You know, people start out wanting to do this, but it's more than a notion. So if you can explain a little bit to our younger listeners, even our older listeners, because this is very fascinating to me as well, what roadmap would you give for them in terms of taking up a career in cinematography, director, writing, you know, being a producer, you know, things of that nature in the film business?
Well, I mean, one of the first things is that you have to love it. I mean, you have to want to do it. I mean, the easiest way to explain you have to want to do it is that I'm up most until 4 in the morning working on stuff. And if I'm working on a project, like when I was working on self-quarantine, I was working through the days and then into the night. And if you have inspiration to do stuff, I'm the kind of person that if you have inspiration, you just don't stop until you finish getting it out. It's one of those things, it's like you can't shake it. You have to just keep going until you until it's out of your system, basically. And that's how consumed you become by it. It is a business, and I tell everybody that now. There's show business. There's the art side, but there's the business side. And let me tell you that it is a very, very hard thing. Think of it the same way you think of being an NBA player. You know, that percentage of the crop gets to be the top tier. You know,
is it that high?
If you want to be the LeBron, Steph Curry, whatever, you think of those big time stars that you see, right? See on the screen. Most people don't even know. I mean, it just also depends on what you're trying to do. There's all kinds of jobs in the movie field, but of course, lots of people want to be directors and they want to be producers. With that comes the higher end comes money. You need money to produce. You need money for the crews. You need money for the set. The advantage of being a young person now is that you can have a vision, and technology has gotten to a point where you can go out with your cell phone and shoot a movie. I shoot a movie, but you'll be able to convey what you want to get across, and that's really what you want to do to get somebody to give you a chance. You want to see that you can, that you have a vision, and this is how you can put your vision together. They'll also, by seeing that, they'll also see how hard you are, you're working at it, or what they'll see what kind of vision you have, how hard you'll work at it. And, yeah, of course, they'll also see things that you're missing, but no one's expecting you to be perfect when you first start out. So the idea that everybody else says, if you have a vision, you need to just go shoot it. Part of my thing with everyone, like when I do workshops, is I'll say, give yourself a pat on the back every stage. When you come up with the idea and you write a script and you finish the script, give yourself a pat on the back, because not everybody can finish the script. You go out and you shoot a film, and we call it get in the can, because you shot it. Give yourself a pat on the back, because not everybody can get through pre-production and get through production and actually shoot it. You get through post-production and you finish the film, and you give yourself a standing ovation, because there are so many people that start and never finish. You need to appreciate the fact that you are able to complete something and get it done and put it out there. You also have to have one thing that is so hard to understand as an artist, and that is once you finish it and put it out there, it's out there. And the comments that you get back, some are great, some are just harsh. Some are some you have to be thick-skinned, and you have to understand that your movie isn't for everybody. You have to understand that, and you can't let that slow you down and keep you down, feel sad or whatever. You just got to keep going, doing what you plan on doing, and say, this is where I want to be in 3 years. How do I get here? If that, I need to write this script. I need to get this shot. I need to get it in somebody's hands. I need a certain amount of people to see it. I need to do a short and get it in the film festival circuits and let people see it. I mean, you should develop yourself a plan to get out there, mm-hmm. and how you're going to get your wares seen. And that's
we'll
what
keep,
you have to do.
We'll keep, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, so Keith, you mentioned your movie, Self-Quarantine. So can you tell us more about the movie, a little bit of overview about it, too, and where can one find the movie? And tell us about the premiere in Atlanta, Georgia as well, because I'm interested. I know people will be interested in hearing about that as well. But start off by telling us about Self-Quarantine and then go to your next one.
Yeah, so it's Self-Quarantine. I always tell people it's Self-Quarantine with a D, past tense. When we all got in 2020, the production pretty much came to a standstill in the movie industry. And during that time, I had time on my hands, and I decided to write a script. And knowing I was going to write a script, I was like, well, how can I get it shot? And I get this done, and I decided to write something that would leave a small footprint, a small cast, a small crew, easy locations, and some outside, so you didn't have to worry about, COVID and all this stuff. So I wrote, it took 2 months, and I wrote Self-Quarantine. Started off as one thing, and then I was like, you know what, let's make it into this thriller sci-fi. And that's what it became, a thriller sci-fi. It's a 90-minute movie. It's about three African-American women who are all dealing with the social isolation of a worldwide pandemic. I don't say COVID, but a worldwide pandemic. And they're tired of it, so they decide to get away and go on a mountain retreat for a weekend. And while on the mountain retreat, strange things start to happen to them that make them question their grip on reality. And that is the movie. That is the suspense and the thrill in trying to figure out what's going on, what's happening.
And your timing was just impeccable. I mean, you're a genius for coming up with that. And everything just coincided with what we're dealing with today. So go ahead and finish. That was just amazing.
Well, I would say the idea for it and the way we shot it, and we shot it basically, we shot it and finished within 8 months. So we shot in March, and we basically, 10 months. We shot in March and finished and had our premiere in Atlanta in January of this year. So it was, as films go, it was a quick shoot, quick turnaround. I really put a lot into this movie. As an indie filmmaker, sometimes you work on big stuff, you work on smaller stuff. This one, I built a lot of the sets. I built those, hand did stuff, did a lot of special effects. I'm really happy with the way I color graded the picture. So with me, it's always interesting. It's like people would always ask, so, you're cameraman and your editor, which do you prefer the most? I would always lean towards being a cameraman, but a cinematographer, but I usually love the editing part of it too. And now that I've learned how to color grade, and color grading is making the colors proper for the film, but also that's color correcting, but color grading is when you add something, you move the eye of the audience towards something. You add little highlights here and there that people don't notice at home, but they're being drawn to something. Self-Quarantine has been doing well in Europe and winning awards at film festivals. And one thing that I'm really stoked about to say would be that nobody has really picked up on the fact that some of these scenes that were shot during the day I made at night, or these sunsets weren't really sunsets. I put them in there. And those are the kind of things that as you get as a filmmaker, it makes you smile. But Self-Quarantined, the movie and the actors were all Atlanta actors. They did a very good job under the circumstances we were working under. We moved very quickly, and it's definitely something to see. It is a thriller. It does have that. So the people who get immersed in it, really, they're like, "Well, Keith, stop making these scary movies." So, it's not a horror thing. It's not something that's bloody and gory and all that stuff. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's more of a.
But it gives you that wow factor, then. Yeah. Go ahead.
It kind of leads you somewhere. You know you're being led somewhere. So there you go.
Mhm. 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 Right. Correct.
If you want to see it, if you go to selfquarantinedmovie.com, and then you can stream it there. Stream it from there.
Can you say that a little bit slower, Keith, and spell it out for us?
Self, selfquarantinedmovie.com. selfquarantinedmovie.com. And that's the webpage. You'll get to read about and see the cast and crew and Instagram and all that other stuff, but you can stream it from there. And so you can stream it straight to your computer, phone, smart TV, however you want to do it.
Okay, that's fantastic. The movie was great. In terms of, would you want to, should we start in terms of going on to your documentary? Or should I ask the question, when will we get to see the film, either on Amazon or Netflix or Amazon Prime or things of that nature?
Go ahead. We did a premiere in Atlanta that went very well, and we're very happy about it. So we're now streaming the movie, but we're actually thinking about this fall, the first week in September, I mean first week in October, December, doing a big push around the country and trying to go into theaters. And but it's not going to be like a big industry theater, so big chain. So we'll do what indie filmmakers do. It's used to be called four-walling, where you take your film to a theater, you go in there, and you make an announcement, you let everybody know in the city by doing press and all that stuff, and then it'll be at, you'll be able to come see it at the theater, but it'll also always be streaming. So you can go to selfquarantinemovie.com and stream
it. And here's something that we Is there something that we can do, the public can do, to say get the movie into like our favorite neighborhood theater that we go to all the time?
Always talk to the theater people. Send a note to say, you know, I heard about this indie film self-quarantine. You know, are y'all getting it? When are you getting it? It is, you know, we're going to come. I know for a fact we're going to go to the DMV because, you know, that's home. And, you know, at some point we're going to do a push there and let everybody know and all that stuff. And we're also trying to find out what other major cities we will go to. We're working on that now. But right now, you know, it's an expensive process. So you really have to think of whether or not where you're going to go and how you're going to go there. That's what I was saying earlier about the business, because it is a business. I mean, you don't want to just lose money by going places.
Right.
It doesn't work. That's one of those things when we were talking about Amazon Prime or other streaming services, what people, the general public doesn't know, or I'm assuming they don't know, that when you see people's work on independent films, not studio films,
right?
Independent really aren't making money off of that. There's not a lot of money that's coming. So if you think maybe a stream is like 4 cents, or even if you gave think of it this way: if you gave somebody a good deal and they were getting 10 cents a stream, and they did 5,000 streams in that month.
Mm-hmm.
If you did the math, that's only $500.
Right.
So,
and I was trying to learn about
that's not something. That's not something as a filmmaker I'm willing to do. So the business end is something you always have to be considering when you make something. And you have to know your worth and know what your project's worth is and what you're trying to get out of it first. So I'm not saying that self-quarantine won't get to some of these streaming services later on at the, as we say, end of life, but is we're going to be pushing our four-walling and getting out to the public through the website and various other ways before we go there.
Okay. That sounds fantastic, because everybody should see this film. Keith and his production company have done a great job. And can we move into your next production, your documentary that you did? And I found that this was fantastic as well. Keith has a great eyesight, I see, in terms of capturing the moment, you know. And so if you could you go into talking about your documentary before the memories fade, Voices from the Civil Rights Movement?
I've completed five documentaries on little known African American subjects in history, and that's really what I had been doing a lot of before I did this feature, self-quarantine. And the last one, the next last one I completed was Before the Memory Fades, Voices from the Civil Rights Movement. And I collected interviews from foot soldiers and icons in the civil rights movement. And I was giving them the floor to allow them to speak on how they felt and what they felt was important during the movement. It was very interesting. It was very rewarding. And I think that, you know, up until 2020, I was always going to a university or a museum to show the film, because I was always requested for Black History Month to show the film. And of course that slowed down when COVID hit and everybody was pretty much not going to movie theaters. But it is a great to hear people talk about the movement and get insights. I always thought the reason why it happened in the first place was when I was doing news back for Hearst, we had interviewed Walter Fauntleroy, and when I was cleaning up the year, I said, you know, I don't know if I could have done what you guys did. I said, but it was a different time. Maybe I could, maybe I couldn't. And he said, and he looked at me and he smiled. He said, Keith, when those cameras were rolling, we took that whooping. But when those cameras were off, and then he just kind of winked and smiled. And I was like, so wait a minute now. What are you saying? So, yeah, so that got me going into talking to these people. And I just cold wrote letters and emails to people. And eventually I earned the trust from some people. And once you earn the trust from some, then you were able to speak to others. And the stories that I was told and the things that went on, it was just amazing. It was amazing how they did it. It was amazing hearing that certain places they did one thing and other places they didn't. And sometimes they were violent and nonviolent. You know, it was it truly was something that we hadn't seen before in this country. And the strategies were such a big part of how this worked. And the coming together with the media, it was a different thing. I think it's something, whether you see Before the Memory Fades, Voices from the Civil Rights Movement, or you just look up in history and try to find as much as you can, it is something you think about when you look at it and then take a step back and see what kind of strategies that the people in the movement use to make it go forward. It is very interesting as you go along.
Mm-hmm. And can you just mention a couple or maybe three of the civil rights greats that you were able to interview and film for this documentary?
Well, I know I got the last interview from Dr. Dorothy Height, Dr. Benjamin Brooks. Unfortunately for the movie does have the title Before the Memory Fades, because nine of the people who I interviewed are no longer with us. So I was happy I was able to have them say what they wanted to say about the movement. I interviewed Marion Barry, who was very insightful about some of the stuff that he did. There was some of the musicians that played at the different rallies. John Lewis, they said, other people, of course, John Lewis. Sometimes I just go past John Lewis because I covered him so much when I was on the Hill that when I did the interviews with him, it was a good sit down, a good talk, and he was such a nice man. The stories are great. The stories are just great, and the camaraderie was great. The scary moments are things you should hear. But it was done in the film. I have to tell you, the film was done in a way that, as an independent filmmaker, one of the things you always deal with is finances. And a lot of civil rights footage is very expensive, like $100, $200, $500 a second. So one of the things that I was able to do was I had an illustrator, and we made it more so like for, I would think, people from the seventh grade on would appreciate it. You know, it's the the animation that's done is a different kind of animation. I have some friends, this black couple that lives in the Poconos, they live in Kentucky, and they did the animation, and I think it worked great. But to tell the stories, I mean, it would cost at least $1 million. Didn't have that for this project. This project was a labor of love. That was not. it was
right.
Not being
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, but it is definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, definitely. Which of all the persons that you were able to get interviews before they passed, who would you say made the most impressionable, you know, the greatest impression on your life in terms of the dialogue that you had with them in regards to the civil rights movement?
Wow, I don't know.
Who came across the most powerful of all the ones that you were able to interview?
I have stories from all of them, and the stuff that was off the record was priceless. And
oh,
I mean,
we would love to hear those.
Yeah, I can't tell you those. Because I've never been to another.
We would love to hear those.
They entrusted me with stuff, and I was like, wow, that was just really. I mean, there were something. I mean, there were just because there were powerful moments during the movement, and they were still, they're still powerful. So there's a moment in the movie where they talk about I asked the question, what is the most impactful thing during the movement? And people, you know, some people would say, you know, when Dr. King was assassinated. But other people would say when Swerna Goodman and Cheney were killed. And that's how... You know, because that's how old they were. You know, that's how what they were doing. You know, registering people to vote, and hearing some of the stories, like I said, the strategies. People would go out to register in these small towns to register people to vote, and they would do it. Like after a while, they ran out of money, so they couldn't buy food. So they would go past people's houses at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, dinner time. And try to register people to vote. So the family would invite them in and they could get something to eat. You know, he said you could go all week and not get anyone to register to vote. But once you get that one person, it just seemed worthwhile. I mean, it's a different world. I mean, it's such a totally different world. When I try to explain this to students, the internet.
Yeah.
Could totally connected the entire world. So it's hard for them to understand. I know the 70s was different. The 70s and 80s were different. But the 60s were so much different from the late 70s that it's a whole different world. Because when you think of the 60s, you still think of like the late 50s. So you can throw those
exactly.
Together.
You know, no technology.
How many people had cars? How many black folk had cars? How many black folk? People hang together to listen to the radio. You know, how many people had the transistor radio? There were cell phones.
And if you had a television, your family was rich and everybody hung down your house.
Right. You had a television, really. that's the way, exactly
that
the way it was.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think, you know, young people really realize that. That's why your work is so important, you know, to our community and to the world, because, you know, other nationalities don't know this information as well because it has impacted their rights, their civil rights, and have advanced them, you know, into our society as well. So, you know, I think that's a really, you know, great piece. And, you know, young people need to know about that.
I'll tell you, here's one for you, since we'll bring it to D.C. I also talked with Eleanor Holmes Norton, and she told this story that, you know, she went down to meet with Medgar Evers. And Medgar Evers tried to recruit her to stay in Mississippi to work, you know, to work as a lawyer, to help down there. And she left to go to another part of southern Mississippi, and she went, and she explained how she stayed at this little farmhouse, and they showed her how he was supposed to take a bath in this little tin tub. And she said she woke up, she went to take a bath, and while she was taking a bath, someone came and told her that they shot and killed Medgar Evers. He was just with them the night before, the evening before, and he got her on the bus. And she was like, you just don't understand what the emotion she went through when that happened. I mean, that was the movement. That was things were happening. All to get people to write the vote. People write.
Oh, definitely. And for, I don't know whether or not you got a chance. Did you go down to that region, Keith? Because I've done a lot of work down in that region. And so, you know, you can see the aftermath and read about the history and what those, you know, what our folks went through in those regions. And Eleanor Holmes Norton's story is just, that's a powerful story. But that story represents so many more stories of things like that that happen, you know? And did you get a chance to go down that region?
I've been to Alabama. I actually didn't go to Mississippi. I've been to Alabama, of course, Georgia, you know, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
Pretty much,
Yeah, I've been a lot of places. I didn't go to Mississippi. I just didn't have a chance to.
Yeah, go down there. Yeah, we did some work down in the Mississippi Delta region, and that's where most of a lot of the civil rights, you know, movement happened and occurred, and it needed to happen in those regions. And it just, when you talked about registering people to vote, right now it's time for people to register to vote as well. So if don't forget to do that. And, you know, now we're so technology savvy, you can register to vote on your cell phone or at the library, you know. So I want to tell people to make sure you get out, tell others and your friends to get out and register to vote if you're not already registered.
Voting
but
is important.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying voting is important. I always, you know, it was always my mindset that people gave their lives for us to vote.
Exactly. So that's exactly.
You know, and I'm talking about not military people. That's one thing. I'm saying black folk put themselves on the line for us to vote. So I'm voting. That's always been my mantra. So.
Right. Oh, definitely. It's been mine, too. You know, because my mother can tell me about them bathing in the little tub up here in Washington, D.C., in the Georgetown neighborhood where our family and my grandmother and she came from, you know, washing in those tin cans, and to what they went through in terms of just trying to register to vote. And, you know, the hostility and everything that they went through and what they had to endure, it was just incredible. So, you know, I cannot even fathom not taking the opportunity to remember what so many of our ancestors and relatives and other people in other races gave up. You know, a lot of people lost their lives to register to vote. And that's how important it is. And I just want people to know that, not just young people, but everybody to know that. And so it's not a year, you know, or election that doesn't go by that I don't participate in some, you know, form or fashion. Because I have to do that in the spirit of my ancestors who gave so much for us to have the freedoms that we have today. So can you tell us any more? Can you tell us some more about your other works that you've done, and where can they? And where can you? Where can people go and see the documentary Before the Memories Fade: Voices of the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, we're Before the Memories Fade came out back in 2013. So the only way to get it now is, we sell the DVDs from the website, my company website, which is plumgoodproductions.com. So if you go to plumgoodproductions.com, look at documentary. It's there because, you know, as the years pass, you know, interest in films passed too. So it's not the latest one that I've done.
Definitely.
But, you know.
It's important. Yeah, we gotta keep that type of work alive. Can you tell us the website again, Keith, and do it a little bit slower so people can write it down?
Oh, okay. So it is Plum Good, PlumGood, Production, productions.com.
Okay, thank you. And that's pretty much, people can order a copy of that film from that website, correct, Keith?
Yeah, I think right now you have to, you email us and we'll get it straight for you.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I said, well, maybe I'll even change and put a link on there. But, my focus has always been, no matter, and it will still be, no matter what feature I do, a fictional feature, I'm always still looking into little-known African-Americans and try to tell them. I've still got one in the works called The Man Who Ran the Planet. That's the John Mitchell Jr. story. And most people don't know what John Mitchell Jr. was. Man who lived in, he ran the Richmond Planet, which was a newspaper in Richmond, Virginia. It was a black newspaper. He also ran his own bank, had a movie theater, all this stuff. And of course, what happens with most first, one of the ones I'm going to do before everything's all said and done is going to be about first, because black firsts are always forgotten. I won't say every single one, because we all know Obama, right? So he's going to always be first. But throughout history, the first black person who's done stuff really is forgotten about. Like, I have a distant relative, Jacqueline Henry Benton Plummer, who was the first African-American chaplain in the regular army. And we did a documentary about him, because it was called Restoring Honor, the Case of Chaplain Plummer, because there was an incident that happened and the people in the base wanted to get rid of him. This was back in 1884. And they got rid of him, but he was dishonorably discharged. But all the charges false, and we were able to prove it, because the Army keeps records They keep very good records. And back in the early 2000s, there was an Army review. There was a committee to clear Jacqueline Plummer, and it went through all the channels and everything. And the Army actually cleared it and gave him honorable discharge. And because once all the facts were out, the state, Maryland, did a resolution. The Senate and the House in Maryland did a resolution. The governor signed it. It was once they found and saw all the evidence that they overturned it. But again, he was a first, and most people didn't know about him in history. There are lots of like people who came out and did stuff, but you hear about the second or the third person, but you rarely hear about the first person, because the first person had to endure all the trauma and all the vitriol and all everything that was thrown at them, and usually they got crushed one way or another. And the second person, the third person picked up the mantle, and that's who we know. So I'd really like to do something on the first, because those are definitely stories that most people don't know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And those are the type of stories that we have to keep abreast, you know, in our for our children, so they can find out about how rich our legacy is and our heritage is. And we're getting ready to wound down, and we're getting close to ending of the session of this broadcast. But I wanted to share something with the audience, and to Keith, how much is the film, and do you do Cash App or Zelle or one of the other electronic devices?
The film is, as we say, it is 840 something with tax. So it's,
okay. All right. Okay. All right. And can you give us your Cash App or your Zelle or information in terms of some?
You just go when you go straight there to the
to the website.
The stream from self quarantine. It goes right there.
Okay. That's good. That's good for the audience to know. And I just want to thank you again, Keith, for for coming on the show. And hopefully everyone will get a chance to screen your movie, Self Quarantine, as well as order your documentary Before the Morning, Before the Memories Fade, Voices from the Civil Rights Movement, by Keith Plummer. And another piece I wanted to leave, which is they are providing free test kits again for the third round of the COVID, of this COVID monster that we're dealing with. And it's a special that the United States Post Office is providing. So if you have a pen or pencil, if you want to take down this website address, it's special, special.usps.com, and it's test kits. And you can get a free test kit. I think they send you up to eight kits per order, and it's free. So I wanted to share that with the audience. But, too, Keith, I can't thank you enough for coming on. And, you know, we're looking forward to even greater things from you. And we have to keep in contact so we can continue to support you. And thanks again for coming on. Is there anything else you would like to leave with us before we depart?
No, I'll just say, again, you were asked earlier about what kids could do. It's like, if it's in your heart and you really want to do it, you just got to keep striving for it. Keep working at it. And keep working at it.
Okay.
Well,
thank you. I'm glad you did, and I enjoyed having you and talking to you. I haven't talked to you this long since Miss Taylor's science class.
Yeah.
And you know how long that's been, right? And for everyone that doesn't know, that's like 10th grade, and that's been years ago. But Keith and I were good friends in high school, and we remain now. We're back friends again, and I really enjoy having him, and I'm hoping that our audience enjoyed the dialogue as well. And hopefully we'll get some more feedback and comments the next time that we're on. Thanks again for supporting Nia2X Radio, and we look forward to hearing some more from us. Thank you, everyone. You have a nice evening. God bless.